Hello, and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else,
a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country and around the world.
This podcast is produced by faculty and staff in the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana.
And now, let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else.
Good afternoon. My name is Florestina Payton Stewart, and I'm an associate professor at Xavier University of Louisiana, as well as the faculty in residence here in our Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development. I'm delighted today to be speaking with Dr. Cheryl Talley. Hi, how are you doing, Dr. Talley?
Oh, I'm good, thank you. Happy to be on the call with you.
Thank you. I'm going to briefly introduce you to our audience. Dr. Talley is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Virginia State University. She teaches neuroscience in the Behavioral and Community Health graduate program and conducts research in student retention in STEM. Dr. Talley received her bachelor's degree in biopsychology from James Madison University and her master's and PhD from the University of Virginia in psychobiology. Dr. Talley has recently shifted her research interests from rats' brains to freshman brains. And Dr. Talley co-leads a team of graduate students and undergraduate researchers in examining the effective factors associated with motivations in African American students with particular interests in science and mathematics. I'm very happy to have you on this call, Dr. Talley. I was introduced to you by a recent blog that you submitted, and the title of that blog was What It Means to Be a Black Scientist. And the blog was very familiar to me. It resonated with me. And most important, I really love how you spoke of the mission of the university and how that relates to the relationship we should have with students. So for our audience who have not had time to read the blog, could you please give us a brief summary about the blog and also let us know what inspired you to write about what it means to be a Black scientist?
Wow. Well, I had been living what I was writing about for 20 years before I'd ever put pen to paper about it. The issues around being a Black scientist, for me, were never conscious. I mean, I know I was working hard. I knew that I had a relationship with my students, and I was advising other people's students, and at the same time trying to keep a research program afloat. I looked around at my colleagues. I looked at my faculty evaluations, and I knew that I was doing things that other people weren't doing, and I wasn't getting credit for some of those things, like advising other students, like inviting students to be a part of a research team who had an interest but not necessarily a background. So this idea of a mission has resonated with me for a long time, because I felt I had received so much from other people and that I owed it back to the community, that I needed to do more with my PhD than just attain for myself. And so I had never actually spoken these words to myself or written them down, but I knew that I was living it. And I think there was an impetus to actually bring all this to conscious awareness when I was asked by a graduate student that question, what does it mean to be a Black scientist? And as I started to answer him, I actually started choking up. I mean, like, I was in an interview with this guy, and tears started coming to my eyes, and I had to stop myself and say and just inquire, what is all this emotion? And that's when I started to write, and it just came and came and came.
Wow. So a lot of the work you were doing, it was, you were just doing this because of who you are and because of your background and what you wanted to give your students. There wasn't a script. It wasn't stuff that anyone told you you had to do, but it was something that we know, I'm going to say we know because I feel the same way that you do, that it's important for our students.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Exactly. So in the blog, if anyone has read it, I know you lured me in, being that my background is chemistry. When you started talking about the actual chemical reaction for producing nylon, and that's how you described this graduate student, like, pulling at you for us the questions and stuff, and I really love that analogy that you give. Could you elaborate on that for our listeners? Like, what did you mean by that analogy? I think you spoke about it a little bit in the beginning when you were talking.
Yeah, I was introduced, I think, to science formally at a camp, and I don't even remember where it was, but somewhere I saw that reaction, and it's so stuck with me as magical.
Yeah.
That I can't even imagine how human beings know how to do such things. I just left with such amazement. And even though I had tried my stint at being a good chemistry student, it just didn't work out between us. So we parted on good terms. But I went towards biology and biological psychology in the end. But I've always kept that picture in my mind, the wondrous illustration or actual demonstration of chemicals working and this thread coming out of liquid and just continuing and wrapping around the glass rod. And as I dealt just with my own inquiry into these emotions, a liquid snake was the perfect analogy for it, because I just felt that there was such a depth there. And if this student kept asking me questions, I could just go deeper and deeper and deeper into these feelings. They just ran so deep, this commitment to the students and my exhaustion and the feeling that it's never going to be enough.
Wow.
And I think that's all what the tears were for, not giving myself permission to call it enough, that looking across the landscape, especially in this day and time, when people like me who came up through affirmative action could say we've made so much progress, but then you look across at what we're dealing with and you say maybe not. So I think all of that was that analogy of that liquid snake, for him to poke and poke with a glass rod, and it would just keep coming and keep coming and keep coming.
What I find interesting is a lot of time we're doing a lot of work and we don't realize what we're doing, and it's not until someone stops us and makes us think about all the work that we are putting into things with our daily lives, especially in academia, because there's teaching, there's research, there's service, and then sometimes it goes beyond that with our students, just making sure that our students are whole. And that's one thing that I enjoyed about reading a part of your bio. It said how you focus on helping students to strengthen their academic skills, but it also talks about how you recognize those personal factors such as time management, organization, self-confidence, and how all of that is equally important for academic success, you know, for our students. And and that's something that I wrestle with, but I guess I was captivated to just see that someone else has also recognized that all of those make up that student as a whole, and how we have to tap into those areas and make sure that our students are okay. Another question I wanted to ask you, currently you're at the University of, Virginia State University.
Yes.
Previously, your previous institution, how long have you been at Virginia State University?
8 years.
8 years. So before Virginia State University, where were you?
Yes, I was 15 years at James Madison.
15 years at James Madison. So after being an African-American scientist at James Madison, what actually motivated you to transition to an HBCU?
Mm-hmm. Well, I must start off by saying that there was 10 years between my freshman and my junior year and senior year of college. I took a 10-year hiatus. In that time, I went to graduate school, but in those 10 years, I got married, I had children, I made a life of community relationships and sorority and church and all of that, and then I went to graduate school. So I didn't go to graduate school right out of college, and I think it was because I had those relationships in place, I think I was afforded a level of resilience because being an older student when I went back to graduate school in my 30s. But I commuted an hour from Harrisonburg, Virginia to Charlottesville, University of Virginia. And it was at UVA that I really started to first notice that I was a different student in a lot more ways than just my age. I remember distinctly a conversation with my a fellow graduate student who had been grappling with a similar problem. And then one Monday he came in and he just says, okay, I got it all figured out. And I learned later that he had been at the bar with the advisor on Saturday night. And they had talked shop over the beers. And so he was advancing. And I could never do that. I had to go home and cook dinner right at 6 o'clock and do homework and laundry and all of that. And so I realized, you know, that there would be some things that I would just have to find another way. I had to seek out mentors and do work on my own, that I couldn't necessarily wait for it to be given to me. And that's a higher level of engagement and a higher level of stress.
Right.
So that's how I went to, when I went to James Madison, I was prepared for this different atmosphere. It didn't surprise me of having to do more, thinking in a different way. What I wasn't prepared for was the lack of acknowledgement. I definitely wasn't prepared for that. I wasn't prepared for the evaluations in which my other advisees were not counted or acknowledged. The stress that they were under was sort of ignored. And so my assistance to them wasn't valued at all.
Wow.
So I wasn't prepared for that.
So how does now, looking at junior faculty members, Black scientists now, I mean, what advice would you have them, for them coming in under the tenure clock? Because not much has changed when it comes down to advising or mentoring students.
Right.
So what advice would you have for them coming in?
Well, I definitely say that I give yourself a break. I mean, I know a lot of my stress came from my own expectations of myself, because, you know, we've all come up being A students. And we all want to succeed, but there's a price that one pays. And when I decided that I was going to come to an HBCU, it was because I wanted to end my career having contributed to the next generation in a meaningful way, and I didn't feel that I could do that at the PWI. And I have found that to be true. I have a love affair with my students. I tell them all the time I'm still on a honeymoon. And yet I see the reality of it, that they are coming from some under-resourced schools, high schools, where they've not had science education, really, to prepare. You know, most of the students I have a phobia, outright fear of math. Mm-hmm. I teach biological psychology, and sometimes it's 2 or 3 years since their last biology course. So if we're trying to prepare a population that has a diverse STEM representation, we are failing at it most miserably. And it starts way back at the beginning, long before college. So my research looks at K-12 and looking at what communities can do, and not just depend on schools. What can communities do to provide that, demonstrations and examples and experiences of that magic of chemistry, or the wonderful, the patterns and organization that are in mathematics, not the standardized test kind of math. I mean the wondrous kind of math that shows up in tree branches and how they branch out. I mean, there is so much to science than what we've reduced it to, and to deny students that, I think, is a tragedy. So there are other ways to do it, I'm finding.
That's excellent, excellent. So have you you're partnering with different schools or different communities, different organizations within your community now?
Right. So the research that I've done over the last 5 years has been funded by the National Science Foundation, looked at affective factors. So I'm pretty convinced by our own data that there are some things that have to be addressed in K-12. One, I think one of the more important ones is the relationship to failure. You know, we have a conversation that our kids shouldn't fail. And yet all of us who've taken any kind of math class know that it's not a if you fail. It's a when you fail.
Right.
Absolutely. And that the failure is necessary for the next step. So it's to be embraced. But that's not what this current testing environment teaches about failure. So it becomes a real guttural, people feel the shame associated with it. Your school is not accredited, or your teacher, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so that whole conversation gets mixed up with the student's own ability, so that they feel that they can't, that every course they have to pass glowingly. And so they steer away from STEM because it makes them feel bad. It becomes a feeling thing. I feel good when I succeed. Instead of, I feel good when I work for something, keep failing at it, and then I succeed. So that's where I want to start with students as young as fourth grade, because I have found with college freshmen, if we can reframe and create and it takes a community to do it, a community of learners that where we're all failing, and it's no big deal, and I have failed, and you will succeed eventually, and this is what you have to do. So the three things that come out of those 5 years of research is that we cannot assume our students have the skill set, first of all, to be a good college student, because the standardized testing environment does not necessarily teach good academic habits. So second, we have to be able to provide an environment in which they begin to know themselves as successful students. And a lot of our students don't think of themselves, that academic identity, don't think of themselves as successful students. And the fourth is that relationship with failure, and we attack it by teaching metacognitive skills, the ability to look at your own emotions, examine them, choose differently. That's a skill, like riding a bike. There are lots of metacognitive practices like meditation or journaling, but to be in the moment of that failure emotion, I've seen students make rash decisions like drop out or get mad at the professor and say inappropriate things, or, because they're all in the throes of those emotions and they've not learned the skills of that emotion regulation. So with those three things, I'm taking that to K-12.
Awesome. That is good work that you're doing. Um, I
again, even with the blog and what you're doing with K through 12th grade, fourth through 12th grade, catching them early, building the confidence and skill set in the students so that once they do step on a college campus that they're confident enough to take on STEM courses as well and math courses.
Yes.
I want to, because our time is coming to an end, but I wanted to know if you would just close us out with, I guess, articulating just in one sentence, if you can, I mean, your overall arching question, the title of your blog, you know, after you've done this and you have all these numerous responses, you have individuals such as myself reaching out to you, just thanking you for your words. What does it mean to be a Black scientist? In a positive light, I see that you are a Black scientist who have reached out to a community who understands what you wrote, who want to continue going, and who are, for myself, hopeful in knowing that I'm not alone and knowing that it does take a village, and maybe all of us can come together and be that village to help our future generation of Black scientists. So I'll go back to my question, and I'll let you close out with all of this attention that you've received behind your blog, the attention that you received from the graduate student who made you dig deep 20 years worth of what does it mean to be a Black scientist today to you?
Well, it means that I can decide what success looks like. To be a Black scientist means that I come to it with all of the history, all of the compassion, all of the mission-driven thinking and caring as George Washington Carver. And I could even bring all the skill and the determination as Everett Just. But I have to realize at the same time that this is the context in which I'm living, and not ignore it, and not try to make it better, but to embrace the constraints and do the best that I can.
Thank you so much. Well said. Last question.
Mm-hmm.
What direction would you like this conversation or the dialogue after the blog, what direction would you like us as Black scientists to move in?
Well, I know that we're all so, so rushed for time, and there's so many responsibilities that we have. But this forum of writing our responses to each other could be very powerful. I didn't realize how much until I, you know, laid my soul bare and didn't know that what kind of response there would be. But being reflective, taking some time to share in writing. I know we have a lot of meetings, but writing slows you down. And sharing with others has really been cathartic for me. It's really been healing for me. So I hope that STEM Central is one avenue. I hope that we can continue the conversation.
Thank you so much. I want to thank you for your time, Dr. Cheryl Talley. Thank you for participating in this blog, and I look forward to seeing more blogs from you, reading more blogs from you, and definitely talking to you in the future.
Thank you so much, Dr. Payton. Appreciate you.
Hello, this is Bart Everson, producer of this podcast. I just wanted to say thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please do take a moment to rate and review this podcast on your platform of choice. It does help other listeners find us.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else. For more information, please visit our website at cat.xula.edu.
That's cat.xula.edu.
Until next time, keep on teaching, learning, and everything else.